We're going to open a work session for introduction of committee bills. And as usual, a vote to introduce committee bills does not indicate one support for the concept, but only that the concept introduced as a bill. And that would, it will be referred to the speakers for possible assignment to a committee.
Madam Chair, I move three legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC Draft 833, dated November 20th, 2012. LC Draft 2671, dated February 6th, 2013. And LC Draft 3570, dated February 11th, 2013, be introduced as committee bills.
Okay, Representative Barton moves that LC Drafts 833, 2671, and 3570 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Okay, is there any objection that to these drafts being introduced as committee bills? Okay, hearing no objection, the motion carries and the LC drafts will be introduced as committee bills. I close the work session for introduction of committee bills and open up a public hearing for House Bill 2214. If you could summarize the bill, Jan, please.
Madam Chair, committee members, this measure exempts employees of attorneys from licensure and other requirements on tax consultants and tax preparers. And you also have before you a Dash 2 amendment that was submitted, requested by the State Board of Tax Examiners. It requires tax consultant license applicants to have 360 hours of relevant work experience in addition to being enrolled to practice before the IRS and having passed an examination covering Oregon law.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to call up Ron Wagner, Executive Director of the Board of Tax Practitioners, please. Any certain order or just...
Good morning. For the record, my name is Ron Wagner. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners. We have before you this morning House Bill 2214. As committee administrator provided you a summary of the two changes. The first is to exempt from our licensure laws the employees of attorneys. Currently, our statute provides for the exemption of CPAs, public accountants, the employees of CPAs, public accountants, and attorneys. Also excludes from licensure employees of a corporation who may prepare the tax return for the corporation as an employee of that corporation to be part of their duties as an employee of that corporation. The board is seeking to include from the exclusion, of course, the employees of attorneys. And the reasoning for this is just as it is with employees of CPAs, that they are under the supervision of their employer as employees of CPAs or CPA firm, just as the employees of attorneys are under the supervision of the of their employer, the attorney or the law firm. If there are issues that come about due to their work, then we would expect that to fall under the supervisory duties of their employer, of the attorney, or the law firm. If the duties are, or if there, there are issues that fall under the jurisdiction, it would now fall under the jurisdiction of the Oregon State Bar. I have reached out to the Oregon State Bar to ensure that they are in support of this bill, and I believe that you have written testimony from the Oregon State Bar that they are in full support of this bill. The second issue is regarding enrolled agents who wish to become licensed in Oregon. There are generally two routes that one may use to become licensed as a licensed tax consultant. And I apologize, let me back up just ever so briefly. We have two levels of licensure with the Board of Tax Practitioners. The very first level is you are licensed as a licensed tax preparer. As a preparer, you must take an 80-hour basic tax course and pass that course, and then you're subject to a comprehensive exam administered by the Board of Tax Practitioners. It is a 200-question exam, 150 questions on federal tax law, 50 questions on Oregon tax law and ethics. The normal route for someone is they come in, we look at that as an apprenticeship level. They come in, work, become licensed, work as a licensed tax preparer for sometimes a number of years. The minimum required before they can become the higher level, which is the licensed tax consultant, is to work during at least two tax seasons and obtain 1,100 hours of experience preparing, advising, or assisting in the preparation of personal income tax returns. Also, a licensed tax preparer must work under the supervision of a more experienced individual. Once they have obtained 1,100 hours of experience, worked during at least two tax seasons, they can apply for licensure as a licensed tax consultant. As a consultant, they are recognized as a higher level of knowledge of tax laws. They are also able to work without any supervision at all. And, of course, they can supervise other tax practitioners. An alternative route to becoming a licensed tax consultant is to take an exam that the IRS provides, which is called the Enrolled Agent Exam. Normally, a person becomes an enrolled agent because that allows them to represent taxpayers in proceedings before the IRS. So people will become an enrolled agent. If they have done so, they may come to Oregon and they can take what we call the state-only exam. What that allows is because they have already shown their proficiency of federal tax law, we exclude them from the 150 questions of our consultant exam on federal tax law. What they do is they take what we refer to as the consultant state-only exam, which is simply the 50 questions, testing them on Oregon tax law and state ethics. So once they pass the enrolled agent exam, they come to us, they take the consultant state-only exam. If they pass that, now they're licensed as a licensed tax consultant, can perform the duties as a consultant, again, without any supervision, and they're allowed to provide the supervision of less experienced individuals. The issue that we recognize here is that there are no work experience requirements to obtain an enrolled agent designation. So what potentially can happen is that someone may come into Oregon, they have their enrolled agent designation from the IRS, they come in, because they have that enrolled agent designation, they're allowed to take the consultant state-only exam, a much easier exam to pass for Oregon. By passing that, they may do as I talked about. There are no work experience hours required with that at this time. So someone, in theory, could come in with zero, with never having prepared a tax return in their life, or having prepared very, very few returns, and be licensed at the higher level of licensure. And the board has concerns with that. There are two ways to look at it. Do we see a lot of problems at this time? Not necessarily. But our concern, we are a consumer protection agency, and we are trying to look out for the interest of taxpayers. And we believe it is in the interest of taxpayers when they turn over the most personal information that they have, that they're turning it over to someone who is experienced and well-qualified. There's a difference between head knowledge and being able to pass an exam and having actual real-life experience preparing returns. The other option is to anticipate issues in advance and prevent those issues from ever occurring. And the board is choosing to use that second option. We're anticipating issues. There seem to be more people who are going the route of becoming licensed as a consultant by becoming an enrolled agent first and then coming to Oregon. If an individual receives experience, so we're asking for 360 hours of experience before they can be licensed as a licensed tax consultant. That is in lieu of what is normally required of 1,100 hours. It is less because we recognize their proficiency by having passed the EA exam, but that's on federal law only, not in Oregon, so that's why we have a separate Oregon exam. We see no downside to requiring people be allowed to work with no supervision, who is allowed to supervise others in a minimum and having a minimum number of hours of actual real life experience. So if you have any questions, be happy to answer those.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Kinnamer.
Yes. Regarding, I guess, the amendment piece that you're talking about, how long has our current system of enrolled agents becoming just simply licensed with that additional 50 questions instead of this work requirement been in place?
Okay. Representative Kennemer, Chair Dougherty. That provision has been on the board books for quite a number of years. They've had EA designation, I believe, for 30, 40 years, maybe longer than that, but I believe since very shortly after the inception of the board, we have allowed those who have the enrolled agent designation to take this consultant state only.
And Madam Chair, an additional question, please.
Yes.
Thank you. And, of course, this would be prospective, so current licensed agents would not have to comply with this.
Representative Kennemer, Chair Dougherty, this is correct. It certainly is prospective. It does not affect anyone currently licensed by us as a consultant.
Okay.
That's correct.
Other questions? Representative Thatcher?
Excuse me. Well, I was just curious how an attorney, how do they have to prepare tax returns, too, before they can? I mean, do they have to go through this experience scenario that you're proposing?
So, Representative Thatcher, Chair Dougherty, attorneys do not fall under the jurisdiction of the board as they are under the jurisdiction of the Oregon State Bar. So there is, since they're not licensed by us, certainly we don't have any requirements for attorneys preparing tax returns that they must have some type of experience. They simply are not under the jurisdiction of the Board of Tax Practitioners.
So just a follow-up. So then potentially the same thing could happen there. They could prepare a tax return without having had the experience too, I suppose. But I guess what I'm trying to ask is the enrolled agents, how would they go about getting this work experience without already having been a tax consultant?
Okay. Representative Thatcher, Chair Dougherty, we have always had a provision in place that someone who comes from out of state, we will recognize their experience. Oregon is one of just a handful of states that has any licensing laws for tax practitioners. So if someone comes from out of state and they have worked for preparing tax returns, whether they've been working for one of the large national companies that we would all recognize, or even if they work on their own, we have an affidavit that they complete and send to us, and we certainly recognize the hours that they have of experience outside the state. So if they were self-employed, we would ask for a copy of their business return or a Schedule C from their personal return showing income over a minimum of 2 years, and we would certainly recognize those hours towards qualifying for the consultant exam. So as someone who has never prepared a tax return before out of state or in Oregon, then they would be required to gain that experience. If they want to prepare returns in Oregon, they would be required to, for a minimum of 2 years, become licensed as a preparer and work under the supervision of someone more experienced in order to obtain that experience to now qualify to take the consultant exam.
Just to clarify, so the enrolled agent, they've done all this stuff at the federal level with the IRS, but to come here, they would basically have to go through the tax consultant door. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, Representative Thatcher, Chair Dougherty, that is correct. Anyone who comes in as an EA, certainly they have shown their proficiency with an exam of their understanding of federal tax law, and we do recognize that. Mm-hmm. But, of course, they have not passed any competency exam regarding the knowledge of Oregon tax law and knowing the ethics of the board. So that's why, yes, we do have, and it's always been in place where they must take at least the consultant state-only exam to be licensed in Oregon.
Madam Chair, I've been understanding that there have not been any problems. I mean, just very minuscule compared to maybe the other categories of tax folks as far as complaints or disbarments or suspensions or anything along that line. So I don't know. It feels like we're kind of searching, a solution in search of a problem sort of scenario with the amendments anyway. And so I have some concern.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Widener and then Mr. Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thatcher touched on some of the issues, but in the opening part of your testimony, you said there hasn't been any problems. So why would we want to put a barrier in place for people getting into the industry? So if they move to the state and they're already licensed, certified, and they went through 1,100 hours for the Internal Revenue Service, which is the very complex tax code, why would we want them to require an EA to take another 360 hours for state.
Okay. Representative Widener, Chair Dougherty, I apologize. You mentioned that, I made a statement that people as an EA have 1,100 hours.
Well, that was the CPA, but the EA was different, so I misspoke on that.
Sure. Okay. As an EA.
I was just saying, putting another barrier in place
sure.
for an EA.
And it's really the same concept with our, which is kind of the reason we have two levels of licensure. We think it's important that before someone works without supervision and is able to supervise others, that they have sufficient experience. Having a book knowledge and kind of a head knowledge of tax laws is completely different, I believe, than having actual real-life experience. Many times we've said there's no, there's nothing to replace real-life experience. And we just believe that the taxpayer is much better served by someone. Again, they're working without any supervision. They've never prepared a tax return in their life. They get licensed as a consultant. They come in. They're first clients as they first begin in the industry. Tax law is extremely complicated. The laws change every year. You know, it's the old adage of you don't even know what you don't know. And we think that there's great value of having some minimum level of experience before you're able to work without supervision and, in fact, supervising others. I'm a bit a bit horrid that thinking that someone with never having prepared a tax return in their life would be supervising other people. So I think there's great value. It's a minimum level that we are requiring, a minimum level of actual experience. And we think that consumers in Oregon are best served by having someone who has sufficient, not only knowledge, but some experience when they're going to a consultant where that work is not otherwise reviewed.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
There's basically 3.8 million people in the state of Oregon. How many complaints did you deal with last year on this issue from EAs?
Representative Widener, Chair Dougherty, on this issue, I'm not sure that we received any. And again, our position is that we are wanting to really ward off. We believe that due to, it's a little complicated, but new federal regulations, which just within the last month have actually, there was a court ruling in federal court saying that IRS was enjoined from continuing with their licensing program. But they began one a couple years ago. And because of the new federal program, we're seeing more and more people who are interested in bypassing this new federal program, and the way they do that is by becoming an enrolled agent. So we're seeing more people take this alternate route where before that was certainly more the exception than the rule. And so because we're seeing more people go this route without it, with maybe very little experience, because what we're seeing is people very, very new to the industry going in and want to become EAs immediately, which in the past we saw very, very infrequently, if at all. People went the very normal route. They had their 1,100 hours of experience as a practitioner before becoming a consultant. So the board has looked again at consumer protection and feeling that we would much rather ward off potential issues rather than wait for those to occur. But I understand your statement.
Okay. Mr. Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for your testimony. Just a couple quick things. In Section 1, Subsection 5, employees of an attorney certified public accountant. So does this include independent contractors? Would this include those that are maybe on a temporary placement schedule? Would they be considered employees or not if they're an independent contractor of a firm or for a firm?
Of a law firm?
If somebody's working as the independent contractor, are they considered under this bill an employee of the attorney?
Representative Matthews, Chair Dougherty, that's an interesting question. We would consider them, I would think, and I hadn't even really anticipated the question. I apologize for that. Under Oregon law, as far employment law, certainly they would not be considered under employment law as an employee if they're an independent contractor. So the question is, would the board consider them for our purposes as an employee? We probably would look to do so. So we would look at maybe a slightly different definition of employee than you would under employment law.
Yeah, well, and follow-up, if you might. My question is more about if they're not considered employees, then should they be excluded specifically in this bill as not being if they're going to be an independent contractor? And then also, in the proposed amendment, it says satisfactory to the board. So just give me an example of how the board determines what exactly would be satisfactory in your mind. And I want to be careful, too, and Madam Chair, if you'll just indulge. You know, a lot of folks do this, and they're enrolled agents. I have a constituent here today that's going to be testifying. And somehow, and I know it's not intentional, but we characterize this as people with no experience. We've got a lot of folks out there doing this practice that have a great deal of experience. And yet, I guess I'm curious how the board quantifies whether or not they could meet your mark. And then a follow-up to that, if you could touch on, is there an additional fee that's if they apply for the license, is there an additional fee that comes with that? Do they pay for that license, and what would that fee be? And I'm trying to find the barriers to entry, because if I've been doing this for a while as an enrolled agent, and I'm being questioned as to whether or not I can perform the task to your satisfactory level, I'm offended.
Okay.
And if I have to pay an additional license to continue the work I've been doing for years, again, I'm concerned. So if you could touch on that, that'd be great.
Yeah. Representative Matthews, Chair Dougherty. Yes, the way that the board determines whether they meet the qualifications of the satisfactory of the board is we're looking at whether they have sufficient experience. So we don't look at the competence level. We simply are looking at the number of hours of experience. So we have a board form that is verification of work experience. And so in order to verify that they meet the work experience requirement, they would submit this verification of work experience that must be signed off by the person they worked for. And so it's really as simple as that. Again, if the individual was self-employed, they wouldn't have someone to verify, obviously, their work experience they worked under. And that's where we ask them to provide a copy of their Schedule C or their business return. And we'll make a determination. They basically acknowledge on that form how many hours they worked. And so we ask them to self-disclose how many hours they worked. And then we look at the income level. If they had $300 of income shown on a Schedule C, but they say they worked 500 hours, that doesn't seem to really jive, and we would probably question that. But so we would look and say, is there sufficient income to support what they what they have submitted as number of work hours, then we allow that. But we don't go back and somehow say, look at the quality of work or try to determine whether we think they're qualified. Again, that is actually determined by passing the Oregon exam. So we're looking simply at work experience, and that's done through the work experience verification form. Regarding a fee and needing to be, let me back up just real quickly, regarding needing to be licensed in Oregon. And again, we do have oversight. We're very proud of the work that the board does. We're recognized nationally as the leaders of jurisdiction over tax practitioners in any other state. As we say, you can be a hairdresser on December 31st, and on January 1st, you hang out a shingle and suddenly you're a tax preparer. So Oregon's very proud of the very high standards that we have. If you're an enrolled agent, again, we recognize your knowledge of federal tax law. What we require is that you pass that consultant state-only exam. So we want to verify that you do have sufficient knowledge of Oregon law, because Oregon law, of course, is certainly very different from federal law. So it's just 50 questions, mostly on tax law and some on state ethics. And regarding a fee, there is a fee. And as a first-year consultant, I believe it's $85 per year.
Okay. Somebody that may want to come up. I forgot we had Jan Salisbury from the Board of Tax Practitioners. Does she also want to come up?
Yes.
If you have anything to add or questions to answer, and please identify yourself for the record. I'm sorry, I was going to bring both of you up at the same time.
Right.
I didn't mean to ignore you.
I'm Jan Salisbury from Oregon City, and I'm board chair of the Tax Service Practitioners. I'm also an LTC, licensed tax consultant, and an enrolled agent. I think you know, first-person stories sometimes are boring, but I think in this case, that's what I want to share with you. I originally worked with the IRS for over 5 years, and then when I left IRS, in the process of leaving IRS, I found that in order for me to prepare taxes, and this is way back in the 80s, early 80s, I had to get a preparer's license, and I was just aghast. I'd worked all these years at IRS. I was a trainer. I knew tax law. I took the preparer's class, which was at that time 80 hours required, which are a lot of hours in a fall, and was very humbled. And I thought I knew tax law. I even taught tax law. Then I took the exam. I passed, became a licensed tax preparer, and that's what I had to work under the supervision of someone. Then I got an enrolled agent's license shortly after that and did the process of sitting for just a state-only exam for the LTC level to get my LTC license as well. Because at that time and still now, in order to prepare returns in the state of Oregon, if you are not a CPA or a public accountant or an attorney, you have to be licensed under the Board of Tax Practitioners. Through the years, other states have gotten wind of what we do and have looked at it, and there are a handful of states that have tried to do that as well. But most states, as Ron indicated, people could put out a sign that say, I are a taxpayer preparer. And there's commercials on TV right now that maybe you've seen where he was a tax preparer the day before and a plumber tonight. So that really is not uncommon. And with the complexity of tax laws nowadays, the licensing issue is extremely important, this certification issue from the federal government. We wholly supported. They looked at Oregon very closely as to what kind of plan we had, and they looked at California, which has a similar plan. So they looked at what we had and used our guidelines at the national level. As to the fact that EAs are not considered as learned, EAs are extremely learned. The exam for the EA exam is even more than what we do through the Oregon, because we, according to statute, we can only govern income tax law. The EA also includes corporate and trust returns and fiduciary returns, and they, according to state law, do not have to be licensed. And I know people who, that's all they do. They do a lot of corporate returns or they do a lot of trust returns, and they do not have to be licensed by Oregon law. The concern the board had about adding, well, I'm not going to speak on the attorney issue because I feel that's just kind of a housekeeping thing and not a concern, except for one issue. The question about an independent contractor, and if I may add to what Ron is saying, an independent contractor means they are self-employed, they have their own business. My interpretation would be that then they need to go through the LTP and LTC guidelines. They're not an employee of the attorney. The attorney hired them to do contractual work. So then that means they're a business, like I was a business, or am a business for many years. Well, the other thing I wanted to say about the licensing issue before other comments here.
I was going to say, if we could wrap it up, because we have three or four other people that need to speak. So
yes, okay. Just from my experience, after I became licensed, I also became an instructor and had taught classes for many, many years, including the basic. A lot of people approached me through the years. They said, I'm not going to bother with LTC. I'm going to get the EA, and then all I have to do is take the Oregon part, because the state exam is really hard. And so people did do that and have done that. And our concern at the board is that it's not necessarily as much as people coming into the state, but people hopping through this system quickly without the experience. And personally, I found that I really needed that experience, even though I didn't think I did. So I think that's extremely important. And so that's where the board is. We're thinking that it's just a definite need for future. Granted, we haven't had any immediate problems, but if we can tie up loose ends now rather than after the horse gets out of the barn, then I don't think it's going to hurt anybody.
Okay, fine. Any questions of the panel? Mr. Wynn?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A comment, if I might.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad that we were given the example that we were a tax preparer one day and a plumber the next. We've had testimony on the need for adequate experience and sufficient knowledge. I would suggest that the plumber who goes through a minimum 4-year apprenticeship and more likely 5 years now does in fact have sufficient knowledge and adequate experience. I'm not sure that a 2-month wonder with 360 hours of experience qualifies as either.
Okay. Thank you.
Jan, I just wanted to go back. So are you supportive then of the Dash 2 amendments that
Yes, and I'm sorry, I did not recognize you correctly, Representative Doherty. I'm sorry, and Representative Kinnamer. Yes, I certainly am. And to be honest, I was hesitant at first being an EA myself. I was trying to figure out what it means. And it doesn't hurt anybody who's already an EA. This is for the newbies that are coming in that don't have experience in the business world, basically, and consumer services. That's our big concern. There's a lot involved in it.
Thank you. Any other questions, the panel?
Okay. Madam Chair, if you don't mind, just to clarify, and I appreciate Representative Matthews' comment, and later as I heard Jan, and I certainly agree with Jan. I think that someone has, and I apologize, I think I misspoke not having thought, anticipated the question, but regarding the independent contractor. And I would agree with Jan that if someone is the independent contractor, then they would be subject to the jurisdiction of the board. So I apologize for misspeaking earlier.
No problem. Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, we have four people signed up against. We have Ted Hughes, Daniel Stearns, and I'm going to call those two because I don't want Mr. Witherland to be up here all by himself. So we'll call those two up, and then after that we'll call up Ira Rosenberg and Bill Witherland. And if we can just kind of, you have written testimony that's submitted, just if you could summarize it for us, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, me first? Okay. Just for the record, my name is Dan Stearns. I'm an enrolled agent, also licensed tax consultant, and I'm also a member of the United States Tax Court Bar. And just as a way of, there's only three other people in the entire state that are non-attorneys that are admitted to the United States Tax Court Bar. So I feel that with the question of tax, I'm fairly competent and able to speak on that. One of the things that I think that this committee should be aware of is that regardless of what the tax board people say, it is very difficult for somebody out of state to come here and practice. I moved in from out of state, and it took, and basically due to the regulations here, I was for 2 months forced to be unemployed because, and that was me hand delivering my application in the very day I arrived due to delays. There was no question of competency. Putting more barriers, of course, is just going to make it worse. Also, just to, as a way, I don't think it's mentioned that the Oregon Tax Board only regulates the preparation of one single tax form, and that's the Form 1040. There are many other ones, and they are, and the interaction with all of them is very, can be very complex. So I consider licensed tax consultant to be my lowest license that I hold. It has no weight outside the state of Oregon. IRS does not recognize it. Even IRS decided to regulate tax return preparers. They did not recognize Oregon. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's just one form, one subject. Also, just to point out that the Oregon state of Oregon has no problem with an attorney or a certified public accountant practicing with zero tax experience. And believe me, in my particular practice, I see work from CPAs and attorneys that should not be anywhere near a tax return. So just saying that out of the way. An enrolled agent, just so you know, has the exact same status before the Internal Revenue Service as an attorney at law. There is no difference between the practice that an enrolled agent can do versus an attorney at law can do. The IRS, we are subject to strict ethics requirements and we can be suspended or disbarred. But an interesting side note is, out of all the look at statistics of all the people that were suspended from practice for the IRS, only 6% of them were enrolled agents. The majority, 59%, were attorneys, and the rest were certified public accountants. So we are regulated, we are licensed, we do have to follow many rules. Now, the way that it's currently written, the proposed amendment is that the 360 hours has to be working experience preparing tax returns, or 1040s to be specific, whereas something with my practice, I do a lot of representation issues. I do have to prepare returns a lot because that's necessary part of the controversy product, but it may be that a lot of enrolled agents, and the ones I know, would not be able to be licensed under this, and then they would be forced to, if they would want to come to Oregon, even if they have years and years of experience doing corporate, and maybe, or they could, well, maybe lie on their rep and say, I did 360 hours in the last, or maybe they're maybe starting to retire in the last few years and going a little bit less on their workload. They come here, under the current scheme, somebody for years recognized the same status as an attorney for the Internal Revenue Service, would have to be forced to submit to an 80 hours course, which they only offer, you know, certain times of the year, and I have actually, I helped people prepare for the course, and many times someone that's working with me, I had to say, okay, remember this for the test, but ignore it afterwards because it's wrong. I've looked at the frequently missed questions on the licensed tax consultant. Many of them, they're wrong. Tax law is wrong. One of the reasons why it's really hard for somebody to become licensed through the traditional means is because the test is poorly written. It's more of a gotcha kind of test where they try to people figure out how to stump to prepare. And also also a lot of questions, like I see, at least unless they're misprints from what I'm reading, the tax law is incorrect on it. And so,
just if you could wrap it up, please.
Okay. But anyway, the tax board only has a 23% pass rate on their exam. That should say something. And I guess I'll wrap it up. The reason, and then they just want to raise the bar. They just recently raised from 750 hours to 1,100 hours. And so it just makes no sense, and there's no problem for this solution.
Okay, fine. Thank you, Mr. Hughes.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ted Hughes, and I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Oregon Association of Independent Accountants. That trade association is made up of EA enrolled agents, tax consultants, tax preparers, public accountants, and yes, even some CPAs. It consists of about 500 plus members. They've asked me to come today and ask the question that you're being asked, why would an employee of a law firm be given a free pass when we've had to go through all of the hours and all of the training we have? And I'm not going to go beyond that except to say my many, many years in this building, I have never heard of a state agency coming before anybody and saying, oh, we don't need to regulate those people and license those people, but these people that we license and regulate now, we want to be really tough on them. That's the only comments I have.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for the panel? Mr. Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ted, those accountant members of yours who are not members of the state bar, I presume are not free to practice law in this state.
Well, we may ask for an amendment of that to allow that to happen. I was really thinking about that, Madam Chair and Representative Witt. I appreciate that comment. And if this bill does go forward, I'd like to add my name as being exempt to practice.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Just as a quick point, under every definition of the practice of law in the state of Oregon, enrolled agents, CPAs, and licensed tax consultants do practice law, of all the definitions you can use. our practice is limited, but yeah.
Okay, fine. Thank you, Jim. Mr. Widener?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of curious, and I probably should have done this with the departments up here, but what about all these electronic filing programs that are out there now? What do they fall under, and what would happen with them? You have TurboTax, you have H&R Block as one, and all of these different groups have...
TurboTax is my best friend. I get more business off of TurboTax, resolving problems that it causes than anything else.
Okay.
I would be flippant if I answered that question, Representative White and Madam Chairman, so I'm not going to answer it if you don't mind.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Kenmerian, we need to move on. So.
I understand. I guess I wanted to go back, Mr. Hiss, to your comment about why wouldn't they need to be licensed? And I think the answer really is that under the law, as an employee of an attorney, now that's different from an independent provider, the attorney bears responsibility ultimately for their work, and that attorney has the right to do that kind of work and is subject to disbarment if they do not adequately and appropriately supervise or have materials that are incorrect. So I think that's the justification. And frankly, that's been a historic designation that I don't see how we would overturn.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much. Call up Bill Witherland and Ira Rosenberg. And we need to move on, so I'll give you guys about 5 minutes, if I can. Thank you very much.
I will be very brief.
Thank you. And if you could identify yourself for the record, please.
I'm William Litherland. I'm an enrolled agent, a licensed tax consultant. I have a small tax practice in Newburgh. Unfortunately, it's still a small tax practice. It's not getting any bigger at the moment. But that's not it. I guess... One of the main things, objections I had to the bill, as it affects enrolled agents, is that 360 hours is almost a smokescreen. It's actually over a two-year period. You have to practice over 2 years in order to fulfill the requirement. And so you have the scenario with someone coming in and with an enrolled agent's card and having to work for someone else for 2 years. They might be perfectly qualified, they have passed very stringent requirements by the IRS, the Treasury, and yet in Oregon we turn around and make them serve another apprenticeship. And I think that's counterproductive. A lot of enrolled agents don't even do personal income tax. Almost half of my practice is corporate law, and only because I occasionally have to do a 1040. It's pretty hard to turn down the company president when he wants his return done or he wants his kids' return done because they've got their application for college in and I need that 1040 easy really quick. Can you spit it out for me, Bill? And okay, so we have to be knowledgeable in all things, but the enrolled agents exam is so much more comprehensive than the state in that we do to get into heavy into partnership and corporate and trust law and so on. The other thing is that I object to in the bill is the fact that it's taking the attorneys back office staff and letting them go ahead and do returns without other than the attorney supervision. And I don't see any difference between that and my being able to hire staff, not license them, work in my office, and then as long as I sign the return, it's legal. But that's not true here in Oregon. My staff all has to be licensed by the state of Oregon. And I don't see any reason why an attorney's staff shouldn't have to be either.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Ira Rosenberg, an enrolled agent. I'm also president of the Oregon Society of Enrolled Agents. I'll make it brief because I know the time's an issue. Just speaking against the amendment on a couple of points. One, I really object. It's like taking a sledgehammer to kill a mosquito, looking at a perceived problem that hasn't even occurred, yet the net effect is if you have an enrolled agent without the experience, the only way they can get the experience is to become a licensed tax practitioner, which means take the 80-hour course, pass the test, and work 2 hours, even, and in the past, You've already exempted enrolled agents from that, but there's no way to get the experience without doing that. And the other point he's trying to make is 360 hours of experience to become an LTC. I worked many years as a manager, and I know I've had some great employees that you promote to supervisors and a terrible supervisor. Just because they've worked for 360 hours as an employee does not mean they're going to be a good supervisor. That is really a poor way of determining that they're qualified to be a supervisor.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of this panel? As a wife of a CPA, I appreciate your being here on February 15th because I understand how busy you guys, you gentlemen and ladies, are. So thank you very much. Okay. I close a public hearing on House Bill 2214 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2340. If you could summarize the bill, please.
Hello, Madam Chair, committee members. House Bill 2340 deletes the requirement that the Office of Emergency Management provide workers' compensation coverage for qualified emergency service volunteers who are injured while performing emergency service activities.
Okay. Call up General Caldwell and Martin. Are you Martin Plotner? Thank you. Welcome, gentlemen.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. With me today is our Office of Emergency Manager Director, who's relatively new to the game. Introduced to you to Martin Plotner, Marty Plotner, retired Lieutenant Colonel from the Air National Guard, and he's now the head of our emergencies, Office of Emergency Management.
Thank you.
Today, 2340, and I'm going to let Marty explain it, is, in our view, something that we believe the law was passed in 2009. We think we don't think the legislature fully understand the impact when this thing passed, nor did we. We understand it now, and that's why we're before you to offer some changes and some amendments or some changes to the law that we think will make it work better, and I'll let Marty explain that. So go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marty Plotner. I'm the director of OEM. What we're proposing in House Bill 2340 is an amendment to the language that revises statutes 401-358 and 401-368. The current statutory language does not recognize the appropriate public body element when it comes to the workers' compensation covers for qualified emergency service volunteers. To give you a little history and to go back, General Caldwell mentioned in 2009, the legislature approved House Bill 3021, which covered not only qualified emergency service volunteers, it also covered qualified search and rescue volunteers. It was found at that time to be too vague, and in the 2011 session, the legislature passed House Bill 3490, which modified one of the statutes to place the responsibility to provide workers' compensation coverage for the search and rescue volunteers with the county sheriffs. Now, what we're not proposing is that this burden be put on the county sheriffs. What we're requesting is that the word public body be used. Out of the estimated 45,340 emergency service volunteers across the state, 11,000 of those belong to fire departments. Many of those belong to the Red Cross and other recognized entities that have systems and registration and training in place, as well as systems for workers' compensation. What we're proposing is that this language complete that correction that was made in 2011 for search and rescue and allow that to the requirement to be removed for qualified emergency service providers from my office. It's estimated based on the cap for the volunteer insurance coverage, while I have no quote-unquote hard costs other than managing the registration portion of these volunteers, our agency alone would be liable for an estimated $1.2 billion for these volunteers because the cap of the volunteer insurance coverage is at $25,000 per incident. Now, this is assuming they all would have a claim or all would fire, but in the Department of Justice opinion, that's a huge liability to have just sitting in the background of a small agency.
Okay. Thank you. Do you have any questions of the panelists? Mr. Widener?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, General, it's funny. I remember all those bills because I sat in every committee that they went through, and now I'm in a completely different committee and
have this for us here.
It's following you.
It's following me, so I'm wondering if I'm the problem, possibly. So I'm just going through it, and everything makes sense on this, but are we sure we're getting everything covered this time? Because, like I say, it was 2009, 2011, and here we are in 13. Have we went through it with a fine-tooth comb to make sure we're getting it taken care of and these people protected and not putting any barriers to people jumping in and helping when we need help?
Madam Chair, Representative Widner, I would hope so. Nothing is, as these things play out, sometimes you learn things later on that you didn't fully understand before. There are some concerns, I know, at the local level, and the counties are going to testify. I think they're a little bit concerned about some of the language in here. Frankly, bottom line is the counties do a good job of doing this right now, covering their workers. And what we say in this change is that they still have that option to do that. But essentially, the only way that, and we were looking at scenarios as we walked through this, we were all aware of the Cascadia subduction zone that is been told by the certified smart folks and scientific community that that's going to happen one of these days. Well, we estimate that's 20-some counties, would be at least 20-some counties, if not more, would be impacted by that. Everything basically from the Cascade Mountain Range west. Now, you take that and you throw that into the equation, and as it says in here, you have to have a declaration of emergency, a state declaration of emergency. Well, you'd have it in 22 counties. We don't have a registry of all of those volunteer workers right now, but they would have to come into play, and then potentially the state would be liable for all of those workers in that particular massive scenario. So again, I think counties do this well with search and rescue. That was really the concern, I think, of the original 2009 effort. If you recall, we had the Kim issue, Mr. Kim issue down in southern Oregon, and we had issues up on Mount Hood that created some of this whole debate about how do we cover these folks. And that was really what started the whole ball rolling back in 2009. So now as we look at the massive scenario that we have today, and we're doing a better job of projecting those possibilities, this is a fairly frightening load. And if the state wants to accept that, then that's up to the state. But I don't think the legislature really understood that. We didn't back in 9 or 11. And as we kind of ran it out and saw, well, what if, then it becomes pretty massive. So that's why we thought it was important that we get this, either changed or head nod that no, the legislature wouldn't want it that way, which is fine with us. We just want to make sure you're aware of it, of that potential liability. And we think we've done it with this legislation now.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Witt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm possibly having two problems here. One, I believe a session or two ago, we passed a bill that provided workers' compensation coverage for volunteer firefighters. The consistency problem that I'm having is many of those firefighters, volunteer firefighters, perform the very same services that emergency service volunteers provide. So I have a little trouble with that. But possibly more trouble, many of those volunteer firefighters in times of emergency are actually emergency service volunteers. And I'm concerned whether this bill might remove the coverage that they would otherwise enjoy as volunteer firefighters.
Representative Witt, Chairman Daugherty, what we're really trying to do with this is actually prevent that from happening. Currently, with the burden being on the state, if they were a qualified emergency service volunteer and a volunteer firefighter, depending on their statute, would depend on where they needed to register for that claim and what status they were in. And what we're trying to do really with this is say, if you're under the jurisdiction of that local fire jurisdiction or that local Red Cross or the county, then that jurisdiction would register you, train you, put the restrictions on what your capacity was supposed to be for that field, and it would stay there. And if you had a claim associated with that, it would go through that same body of that public entity or jurisdiction. Versus the way it reads now, if they're in a volunteer fire position or search and rescue, and they change their status to become an emergency service volunteer. Now they need to register with the state and follow a different course of action to get their claim settled.
Okay. And if we need to move on with questions, so follow up, Mr. Witt, and then Mr. Widener.
Yes, thank you. Has MLAC taken a position on this bill?
Okay. Not to my knowledge.
Mr. Widener.
Real quick, have we contacted SAFE at all and talked with them? Because it seems like there'd be something we could possibly do, work this with SAFE.
They worked it with the other.
Just kind of thinking outside the box here a little bit, and I know they have probably a lot of reserves where they could probably do something with that agency.
Representative Widener, Chairman Doherty, SAFE and the Department of Justice actually reviewed this to show the exposure and came up with the numbers on what the liability would be for our agency and the state. So they're well aware of it, and it was their recommendation at the time that this was reviewed about 11 months ago to make it consistent, such as the search and rescue volunteers were.
Thank you. Other questions? I do have one definition question. When you talk about the volunteers, are these things like search and rescue? We have local CERT teams in Washington County. That's the kind of volunteers you're talking about.
Madam Chair, I might just mention one other thing. On the second page, line 13 and 14, another one of our concerns we want out of there is right now, as I said, emergency workers need a declaration of emergency like the scenario I briefed, but it also requires that during a volunteer engaged in training being conducted by a local agency. We have no way to monitor that training. We don't have a staff to do that. We have no way of knowing whether or not that training is being done safely, appropriately, or anything of the order. That's up to the local governments to decide what they're going to train and how they're going to train and where they're going to train. But yet the state's on the hook for that. So we don't believe that was the intent. We don't think that the legislature intended that at the time, and if that's the case, then that's fine, but I don't think it was real clear then, which is another reason for that.
Fine. Thank you very much for the clarification. Okay, the next panel, Mike Eliason and Alex Cooler from Lane County and AOC. Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Kyler.
Thank you.
Okay, I've got to butcher one name a day, you guys. Can we have a slack here? Excuse me, it was your name that... Sir.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, I'm Mike Eliason, General Counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. We appreciate the testimony of General Caldwell and Office of Emergency Management, and certainly willing to work with them on this bill. But we're starting to hear for some counties, especially those that are self-insured, that this is more than just a slight technical change. It's a fairly major policy shift. Hasn't undergone a lot of discussion between the state and local governments to this point, and we think it might need some to get where ultimately we might want to go with this. As was mentioned earlier, the emergency service volunteer statutes were extensively rewritten in 2009 through the Oregon Law Commission project that took place in the interim leading up to 2009. Section 5 of that bill added the language that the Office of Emergency Management is seeking to alter today with this bill. Much of the focus of that work on House Bill 3021 in 2009 revolved around search and rescue volunteers, and it's now clear that qualified search and rescue volunteers performing activities under the direction of the sheriff of the county are considered agents of the county, and the county would then provide workers' compensation coverage for those qualified search and rescue volunteers, and certainly no dispute about that, and that underwent extensive scrutiny. However, in the situation of a more general emergency services responder who's performing activities under a state of emergency declared by the state, current laws, at least some counties are interpreting it to us, is that the state's designated more as the overseeing entity, directs where to focus volunteer efforts, and in our eyes, to some degree, decides the exposure to the hazards, and that's reflected in the way the current statute reads right now, that the Office of Emergency Management is responsible for providing coverage in those situations. One of the other questions that this bill has raised with us at this point is, by replacing the language that OEM shall provide workers' compensation coverage in these situations with the county may, it, you know, sort of opens up the question is what happens if the county doesn't. It appears, or if there's, is there simply no coverage, that would be the way it appears to us. And if these emergency service volunteers were then considered to be agents of the local public body, whether it was the county or another public body, that public body would then be exposed to tort liability should they not be providing the coverage. So, long story short, we'd like to probably have an opportunity to discuss this in more detail with the Office of Emergency Management and General Caldwell and the Military Department folks. Certainly would be happy to do that, but at this time, you know, we're not sure that this is, at minimum, I think the language needs clarifying, and we're not even sure that necessarily this is a policy direction that that we're interested in undertaking at this time.
Okay, I do encourage you to sit down and talk with him for a while, though. Mr. Kyler.
Thank you, Chair Doherty. I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager, and I really don't have a whole lot to add other than I spent a lot of quality time with County Council and the Oregon Law Commission in 2009 in a room trying to address this issue of the self-insured counties, those counties that provide workers' comp not through the SAFE system. And the issue there is that if you have sort of one person who has to go into SAFE, then all of your employees have to go into SAFE. And so we spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out how to address the self-insured counties, and notably in that case, Clackamas County, Lane County, Deschutes County all have fairly large loads with regards to search and rescue volunteers given our proximity to the Cascade Range. So there was quite a bit of time spent on that particular issue, and that the language in House Bill 3021 was specific to search and rescue volunteers. So to sort of expand this now to more of a, I think it's defined in House Bill 2340 as a qualified emergency service volunteer. We just want to have, I had a very brief conversation with our risk manager this morning about what that pool of insurance says, if it's specific to search and rescue volunteers, or if it would cover us if we had a greater number of volunteers that were not necessarily search and rescue, but were involved in sort of the major kinds of issues that the general described. So we're, like I said, we're not necessarily opposed to this. We would just like some additional time to ensure that those of us who are in self-insured don't fall into an unintended consequence, and that's what we were trying to do with 3021 back in 2009.
Okay, thank you very much. As I say, I do encourage the parties to get together, sir. There have been some good questions that have been brought out. Do you have any questions of the panelists? Okay, thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2214. Excuse me, 2340. Did I do that right, or do I have to redo it?
Nope, you're right. 2340.
And I open a public hearing on House Bill 2478. Jan, if you could summarize the bill, please.
Committee members, this is a bill that extends the sunset to the year 2020 for tax credits that are for payments to employee and dependent scholarship program. You have before you some suggested questions from the Joint Tax Committee for review of this issue. If the committee chooses to pass it on to Joint Tax, they will be looking at the revenue impact. But this committee is to consider the policy impact of having this particular tax credit program.
Okay, thank you. First people to testify. Do we have a list?
Could I just take it?
Okay, I'd like to call up Chris Allenock. This person also. And Susan Dijon from, please. Thank you very much. Are you stating your name for the record?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Chris Allenack with the Legislative Revenue Office. And I was asked to come here and be available to answer any questions about the process and to talk about it a little bit. For those who weren't here in 2011, it's the same process that was instituted in 2011. Leadership decided to follow that same process, where the basic idea is for the Joint Tax Credit Committee to get input on the policy side from the individual policy committees. So there are about a dozen tax credits that are scheduled to sunset at the end of this tax year, and in each chamber, bills were drafted that simply extended the sunset date 6 years, which is kind of a default extension time period. And then those tax credits were assigned to relevant policy committees to discuss the merits of the policy and to evaluate the tax credit as it stood, with a number of options of either ranging from allowing the tax credit to sunset to extending the sunset and expanding it in some way, as well as anywhere in between. And the sample questions that we put together are really meant as guidelines to help promote some discussion within the committee about evaluating the tax credit. They aren't a list of questions. Okay, the Joint Tax Credit Committee isn't looking for answers specifically to each of those questions to be filled out, yes, no, and in detail. They're just meant to be thought-provoking. And the basic guideline is all of the tax credits are in a tax expenditure report which accompanies the governor's balanced budget. And within that, there is an evaluation for every tax credit. They tend to be done by state agencies. And so there have been some criticisms of those evaluations. One of the challenges of evaluating a tax credit in terms of the policy is it's not always clear what the policy intent is of the tax credit. Mm-hmm. So even understanding and having a discussion about why this particular tax credit is put into statute and what is hoped to be achieved from a policy perspective, because only then, once a policy goal is clear, can it really be evaluated, because the evaluation is always a contextual discussion. What is it supposed to do? What is it intended to do? And then the discussion can really move forward in terms of whether or not that goal is being achieved.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Dougherty, Vice Chairs Barton and Kennemer. For the record, my name is Susan Deegan. I'm the Administrator of State Grants and Government Affairs for the Oregon Student Access Commission. I'm here today to testify on House Bill 2478. You have my written testimony, so I will try to summarize that testimony. The purpose of the bill is simply to extend the sunset date of the tax credit for 6 years, from January 1st, 2014 to January 1st, 2020. This tax credit encourages small Oregon businesses with at least 4 and no more than 250 employees to create and sustain employer-sponsored scholarship programs, and we do thank the Revenue Committee for advancing the bill for the committee's consideration. OSAC currently administers more than 400 different scholarship programs, and we award nearly $16 million to Oregon students in the last academic year, the 11-12 academic year. These scholarship programs have a wide variety of criteria, but we have simplified the application process, and students use one application form to apply for any of those scholarship programs, and those are offered by OSAC, by the Oregon Community Foundation, and by the Ford Family Foundation. There are more than 12,000 applications that we received last year, and more than 3,000 students who were awarded scholarships last year. The tax credit is granted only to employers who participate in an employer-sponsored scholarship program certified by OSAC, by our agency. The tax credit's equal to 50% of the amount of the scholarship awards that each eligible employer has provided. The liability that credit is up to the employer's tax liability or a maximum of $50,000. There are also limits. An employer's lifetime amount cannot exceed $1 million, and the total tax credits for the entire tax year cannot exceed more than $1 million. We work with the employer and with the Department of Revenue to certify the tax credits. The
economic recovery has kind of allowed us to again consider working and encouraging especially small businesses to develop these kinds of scholarship programs for their dependents and employees. This extending the date would allow us to continue and hopefully expand our current reach for this program, and it would help us attract businesses as potential investors for the next generation of college students in Oregon. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I thank you for the opportunity.
I'm going to start out the first question.
Yes.
Is that can this tax credit be certified if the student uses a scholarship for out-of-state colleges?
Specifically, the answer to that question, Chair Doherty, is yes. Each individual private scholarship donor determines the criteria for their awards. So of those that currently participate in this program, one is limited to colleges in Oregon, one is limited to colleges in Oregon and Washington because the business does have offices in the state of Washington as well. One does allow a scholarship to go out of state. However, these scholarships are limited to employees of Oregon small businesses and their dependents.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Mr. Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are there instances where a scholarship program would be employer-sponsored and the employees would actually do part or perhaps a large portion of the fundraising for that scholarship?
Representative Witt, Chair Doherty, I don't specifically know the answer to that question, but I could certainly look into that for you. If that were the case, however, it would be my guess that if the employees are raising the funds, that it would not be the employer who would receive the tax credit, so it would not be considered eligible for this program.
Madam Chair, a comment. Presumably, that tax credit is being used as an incentive to raise money. In the instance that was just described, it has every appearance that that money would be raised anyways. I question the validity of this tax credit.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Holvey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this tax credit available to both, the attendance to private and public institutions for education?
Representative Holvey, Chair Doherty, the type of institution that a student could attend and be eligible for consideration for that scholarship is determined by the donor. So it could possibly be. In every single case, these schools have to be Title IV eligible schools, so they have to be eligible to participate in federal Title IV student aid programs.
Follow up. So is there any limitation to the amount of tuition that is eligible for this tax credit? I mean, could I spend $1,000 a month for tuition versus $300?
Representative Holdy, Chair Doherty, I don't think there's a restriction on what the tuition would be. If you're talking about what the scholarship award would be, that's a little bit different. Usually the scholarship funds are dispersed at the start of each academic term, so you don't have a month-to-month tuition payment or
expenses or anything.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, other questions? I do have a question. What is expected to happen if this tax credit fully sunsets?
Chair Doherty, if this tax credit fully sunsets, we will continue to expand our outreach efforts and work with businesses large and small, but it will make it a little bit more difficult probably with especially the small businesses to sustain the marketing and the outreach programs.
Thank you. And the effect, if it was the tax credit was reduced by a certain percentage?
Chair Doherty, I I would expect that you would have a similar situation. We would continue our outreach efforts, but especially with small businesses, it would probably be a little bit more difficult to work with them than it has been in the past.
And how many businesses have availed themselves of this tax credit?
Chair Dougherty, we currently have 3 businesses.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Mr. Kinnamer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is, do we have an estimate of the cost of this program to maintain currently?
Representative Kinnamer, I do not have an estimate of that, but I will get that for you.
I see a hand.
Thank you
there.
Very much.
Excuse me.
I think
he had made me an answer.
Chair Dougherty, Representative Kinnamer, by cost, you're referring to the cost of the tax credit?
Well, there seems to be both a tax credit cost and an administrative cost. And I'm interested in both, frankly.
I'm not familiar with the administrative cost, but the tax credit cost is, by looking at tax returns, it's less than $50,000 a year in terms of a reduction in income tax revenues.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much. We have one other person signed up, Betsy Earls. Thank you for your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries. I was contacted by your committee administrator about this bill, and in response to that, surveyed our membership to see which, if any, offered scholarships of this kind and were able to take advantage of the tax credit. I got numerous replies about tuition reimbursement, but I believe that probably all 3 of the businesses that or were referenced by the prior witnesses were also members of AOI. We had 3 members that took advantage of the tax credit, offered the scholarships to their employees. And to my knowledge, none of them were something that the employees had to work on raising money for. So I would, I guess, respectfully request that you extend the sunset on this bill with the caveat that I don't believe it's widely used among our membership or among Oregon business. So we support 2478.
Any questions of Ms. Rule? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2478 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2070. Dan, if you could summarize the bill, and we have 2 witnesses, Mr. Martinez, and I can't read your handwriting, Jeff.
Sumter. Committee members, this measure affects some banking regulations. There would be able to hold regular meetings once every 2 months instead of monthly. It'll allow the director of DCBS to receive an uncertified copy of the audit committee report. And it permits Commercial Bank and Oregon Trust Companies to invest assets in limited liability companies in specified circumstances. And it prohibits commercial banks to knowingly permit savings accounts to be overdrawn except for inadvertent overdrafts.
Mr. Sumter, is that?
Yes, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tim Martinez on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and Oregon Independent Community Banks of Oregon. I think I'm 3 for 3 this week. You've had 3 meetings. I think I've testified all 3 times on one bill or another. I brought Mr. Sumter today as a real live banker and bank CEO to kind of walk you through the changes in this bill. Just a little bit of background on Jeff. He did serve in the Navy. Most bankers that served in the military were finance officers. Jeff was a gunner's mate on a destroyer, so he was a real Navy man and not sitting in an office figuring out where the beans are coming and going. He is co-president and CEO of his bank, Lewis and Clark Bank, which is also pretty unique. You don't see many banks that have co-CEOs and co-presidents, but he founded that with his co-president several years ago. It's a successful bank up in the Portland area, and he's also on the ICBO board, which again is the Independent Community Banks of Oregon, and he is the chair-elect, which in addition to his duties will also give him a seat at the OBA board. So thank you for hearing this bill. We have met with DCBS a couple of times. I know they're in the back of the room. I don't believe they're signed up to testify, but hopefully they're not jumping up and down when I say I believe they do not object to the bill. I also want to make it clear and put it in the record that if there's anything in this bill that may conflict, and I think they were concerned about that, if anything conflict with federal regs, that federal regs would hold, and that these were not trying to undo any federal regulations, which obviously we can't. In general, I would say that as far as Bank Act revisions, and that's what this is, I'm not going to say housekeeping, I'm not going to say technical, because anybody that's been around a while, your ears are going to perk up. So, but these are things that we do think are needed. The Bankers Association, in conjunction with DCBS and other stakeholders, about every 10, 15, maybe 16 years, go out and rewrite the entire Bank Act to try to make it more modern and keep up with technology. As in any other industry, sometimes the industry gets ahead of the act, and we are going to actually work on that, I think, for the 2015 session. But these changes we felt were needed. Again, you'll see through the amendments that we're giving more discretion to the director. We're comfortable with that. We think that makes a lot of sense. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions or let Jeff kind of walk you through the details.
Okay, Mr. Sumter.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Barton, and Vice Chair Kenmer. Excuse me, I've got a cold this morning. So
trust me, everyone else.
It sounded.
We understand.
thank you. I am Jeff Sumter. I'm the co-president and CEO of Lewis and Clark Bank, and I'm here to talk about House Bill 2070. The first section has to do with the frequency of board meetings, and the current law has a requirement that the board meet once each calendar quarter. This does not allow banks flexibility in setting their meetings, and we're seeking some flexibility in that. As Mr. Martinez said, we worked with DCBS, and this would allow the director to specify the rule and the frequency at which bank boards must meet. And this is a similar setup as how credit unions are organized now. So don't see an issue there. Section 2 is bank audit reports. This has to do with bank board's audit committees. This change is what it allows is the bank audit committee reports to go to the DCBS upon request of the director. Right now, whether the director requires it or requests it or not, we have to send that within 5 days. Mm-hmm. So this would be on their request. And audit reports are recorded in minute books of the banks, and DCBS can, and they do review those reports when they examine the banks. And again, this would be flexibility for the bank and DCBS to limit unnecessary filings. Section 3 has to do with bank investments and LLCs. This doesn't really change the permitted investment banks can make. This just adds LLCs to the list. When this was originally drafted, corporations are permitted, and LLCs were not used as much, and this is just addressing the fact that LLCs are much more common today. And the last section, Section 4, this is overdrawn savings accounts. This is not a, this doesn't happen very often, but there are times savings accounts could potentially be overdrawn. If somebody deposited a check and made a withdrawal and then the check was returned, it could potentially be overdrawn for a period of time. This would give the bank 14 days to address that overdrawn account and not really be a violation. So this isn't a fee issue. We're not, you know, asking for a fee or anything like that. This is just to allow the bank time to address the inadvertent overdraft.
Okay. I do have, before we go on, and then we're going to have to wrap up questions because we've got two other things that we need to pass this morning. You did ask for a Dash 1 amendment. Are you going to address the amendment, or was it addressed?
Yeah, I think it was addressed. Primarily what we're doing there is taking out specific day or times and giving the director discretion by rule to go ahead and do that. And the last one was on this savings account overdraft. We initially had 7 days, and in talking with our members, 14 days was more appropriate. And again, I think to understand that, you know, as Jeff described, these are savings accounts, and mistakes do get made sometimes, and you make a deposit, and unfortunately the check that you're depositing is no good, and so this gives the customer, frankly, time to go in and correct that without any negative results to them or to the bank.
Okay, thank you. And so we're not dealing with fees or anything?
No.
Okay, thank
no,
you.
Madam Chair.
Quick questions. Mr. Holdy?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I can get the answer to this later, but I do have a question about the ramifications of having an uncertified copy of the audit committee report as opposed to a certified copy. Just would like to know that. I don't have to know it right now.
Representative Holby, Chair Doherty, it's my understanding that this audit committee report would be given to DCBS upon their request, but as they do exams now, that's all recorded. The audit committee minutes are already recorded in the board books, and those are reviewed as the exams happen. So the way I understand it, it's more of a upon request than has to be done within the 5 days as it's currently written. Sent down within the 5 days as it currently is.
Okay. Quick question. Martin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding the section, the LLC section, is that just conform the statutory language to what is already practiced, or is this actually changing anything? I ask because I just can't imagine you aren't investing in LLCs already.
Representative Barton and Chair Doherty, when I looked at the bill, I didn't see any changes other than just adding LLCs as a permitted item. Speaking from my own bank, which is a small bank, that's not really an issue for us. This is probably an issue for larger banks. But there was no other changes to that bill other than just adding LLCs in there. So how pervasive that is, how much that's used, I couldn't speak to that.
And I just add, Madam Chair, Representative Barton, members of the committee, I think the last time the Act was updated was the late 90s. And LLC simply were not a very used model of incorporating. So I do think it would be rare, and certainly DCBS is in the room and could answer this question better than I could, but that they would be investing in LLCs. We want the authority to be able to do that.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, close the public hearing on House Bill 2070, and I open up a work session on House Bill 2242. Could remind us about the bill on this one?
Madam Chair, the committee heard this bill last Friday. We heard from the Employment Department. This dealt with the use of the alternative definition of base year, and there was no opposition to the measure. There are no amendments before you. There is no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact with no statement issued by the Legislative Fiscal Office.
Okay. Mr. Barton.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2242 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Representative Barton moves House Bill 2242 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion of this bill? Okay, those of the opinion that House Bill 2242 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye, and those opposed, no. Brandon, could you read call the roll, please?
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative
Thatcher. Aye. Representative Matthews. Aye. Representative Holby. Aye. Representative Wagner.
Aye.
Representative Vagan.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kenner.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty. Aye. Okay, the motion carries. Anyone would like to carry this bill on the floor? I can't remember if this was one that was brought to us by someone.
No, by the Employment Department.
Okay. Come on.
I'll carry mine.
Okay, Representative Thatcher. Thank you so much, Representative Thatcher. She will carry the bill. I close the work session on House Bill 2242, and I open the work session on House Bill 2566. Again, if you could remind us of the bill.
Madam Chair, committee members, the committee heard this bill on Monday. This allows the corporate board of directors to delegate their senior officers to award the equity compensation awards. There are no amendments before you. There is no revenue impact, and there is no fiscal impact on this measure.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barton.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2566 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton moves House Bill 2566 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, hearing none, those of the opinion that House Bill 2566 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed, no. Brandon, please call the roll.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Hagan.
Aye.
Representative
Holder. Aye.
Representative Wayne.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kenner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Chair Representative
Curry. Aye. Okay, the motion carries. Representative Barton would like to carry this bill. And I close the work session on House Bill 2566. Any other business? I adjourn the meeting of the House Committee on Business and Labor. We got